Good afternoon, everyone. This is the Thursday, July 22nd, 2021 afternoon session of the Portland City Council. Good afternoon. Keelan, please call the roll.
Good afternoon, Mayor. Good afternoon, Commissioners. Hardesty, Maps.
Here.
Rubio.
Here.
Ryan.
Here.
Wheeler.
Here. Under Portland City Code and State Law, the City Council is holding this meeting electronically. All members of the Council are attending remotely by video and teleconference. The City has made several avenues available for the community to listen to the audio broadcast of this meeting. Meetings available to the public on the City's YouTube channel, eGovPDX, www.portlandoregon.gov/video, and Channel 30. The public can also provide written testimony to the Council Clerk by emailing at cctestimony@portlandoregon.gov. The council is taking these steps as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic and the need to limit in-person contact and to promote physical distancing. Pandemic is an emergency that threatens the public health, safety, and welfare, which requires us to meet remotely by electronic communications. Thank you all for your patience, your flexibility, your understanding, your resilience, and everything else as we manage through this difficult situation to conduct the city's business. With that, we'll hear from legal counsel on the rule of order and decorum. However, all we have this afternoon is a report. So if you want to give a shortened version, that's fine too.
Mayor, this is Keelan. I believe Matt Farley was going to be the attorney in the box today, and I don't see him connected yet.
Well, we only have a report. So I don't think we need to give the legal statement since we will not be taking public testimony. There may be invited testimony, but that's somewhat different. So why don't we go ahead and call the roll?
I think we did that.
Oh, we already did that. Read the one item for this afternoon, 588. I feel like I've spent a lot of time with you guys this week.
I know.
Anyway, and Dan, thanks again for presiding yesterday. You did a great job on a complex and long day. Keelan, if you could read 588, please.
Yes, I think you might be looking at the July 22nd. This item, I think, is 6.
Oh, you're right. You're right. I am actually looking at it. You know, I grabbed this off a pile on my desk, and it's my recycle pile. That's embarrassing. Yeah, read the correct item for Thursday. That'd be terrific.
Okay, great. 620, accept climate emergency declaration, 1 year progress report.
Perfect. Commissioner Rubio, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, and thank you, Mayor. The climate emergency is here, and our recent heat wave and fires destroying our state are grim reminders that our work to reduce carbon must be more aggressive, more accelerated, and more nimble. And today we have the chance to hear from our bureaus and our community partners about the work they've been doing to implement the directives in the climate emergency declaration. And I want to acknowledge the leadership of the community working together with the previous city council to pass that original climate emergency declaration last year. And also that's what brings us here today. This city has a long history of taking action to fight climate change, but naming it what it is, an emergency, and acting accordingly is important because it literally impacts lives. With this declaration, we have moved towards a new and responsive way of doing climate action planning, one that is community-centered and driven. Yes, we need big actions to reduce carbon at the local, state, and federal level, but we also need these actions to center our frontline communities first by lifting up the lived experience of those most impacted by climate change. This is how we will be effective in our work to mitigate climate impacts that are already happening in real time. This work is exciting, it's innovative, and it's also urgent. And as is always true, frontline and Black, Indigenous, people of color communities have been on the cutting edge of this work. Our invited guests today will speak about some of the work that has transpired over the last year. The Climate Justice Initiative, Pricing Options for Equitable Mobility, and the Build Shift. Three community-led approaches to climate and decarbonization work that the city is standing behind, supporting, and learning from. And we are so honored to have them here with us today. With that, I'll hand things over to Andrea Durbin, Director of the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, for remarks.
Thank you, Commissioner Rubio, and good afternoon, Mayor and Commissioners. I'm Andrea Durbin, the Director for the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. It's safe to say that we are at an inflection point. This last month alone has tragically offered very clear examples that we are living in a climate-changed world. And these climate impacts are destructive, costly, and deadly. From the extreme heat dome that took the lives of hundreds across the region, to the record-breaking Western wildfires with Oregon leading the national headlines, and devastating floods in Europe and China, where cities saw 3 months to a year of rain in a single day. This is what climate change looks like. We've been talking about climate change for decades, and we are running out of time to act with prudence and responsibility to avert the more dangerous impacts of climate change. What scientists are telling us is that this is just the beginning of the climate impacts that we will see. These impacts will be intensified if we continue business as usual. Even local experts like Dr. Vivek Chandas from PSU have warned us that these extreme heat events and of the disparities and inequities in the urban heat island effect across the city. Let's consider this a wake-up call. We have a very limited amount of time left to make choices and decisions that avert worst-case scenarios for our collective future and future generations. We are at that crossroads. And action needs to happen at all levels. Global leaders will be reconvening in November to make new commitments for the International Climate Change Agreement. The Biden administration is prioritizing and centering climate in its key initiatives, which is a welcome change at the federal level. The state legislature made some important progress on commitments to get to 100% clean energy, thanks to a community and environmental justice-led coalition. And the state will be putting its statewide carbon reduction program in place by the end of this year. But the state needs to accelerate its climate actions as well as center climate in its decision-making and address the places where it is standing in the way, such as preventing cities from adopting stronger building standards for buildings, new buildings. But cities are critical to solving the climate crisis because we are most vulnerable to the impacts of climate change and also the engines for solutions. Cities make decisions about the built environment, how we develop our transportation systems and infrastructure. And we also have people living in cities that need to be protected, especially at-risk communities. What that means is that what Portland does matters. It matters because all cities need to get serious and have a way to meet their climate reduction goals, including Portland. What you will hear today is that we have a lot of work to do to get on track for meeting Portland's 2030 goals. It matters for how we adapt and protect ourselves from the impacts of climate change and protect our communities. The recent heat event shows us that we have more work to do there. And it matters because we can lead and model for other cities that this transition to a zero carbon economy and community can and should be beneficial for families, communities, workers, and businesses. Next slide, please. Last June, the previous city council recognized the importance of acting on climate by adopting the Climate Emergency Declaration. That declaration recognizes that if we are to find solutions to the climate crisis, it requires a different way of doing climate policy and planning. At its core, this declaration is about climate justice. It acknowledges that historically, those who bear the burden and impacts of climate change have not created the problem, nor have they been involved in making decisions about how to solve it. Importantly, the Climate Emergency Declaration calls for mobilization, more action, more resources to support that action, and more collaboration that prioritizes frontline communities.
If I may, can I just interrupt? I don't know if your slides are supposed to be moving, but they haven't been moving. It looks like we're caught up now.
Yeah, I'm having a lot of trouble on my end. I'm really sorry about that.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Are you seeing anything right now?
Nope, it's not on the screen.
What about now?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. You can stay one back. One back, Andrea.
Okay. There,
yep. Thank you. So I will tell you up front, we have not mobilized the resources necessary to address the climate crisis in Portland and ensure that we are serious about decarbonizing buildings and the transportation sectors, the two largest sources of emissions. Nor have we prioritized the resources necessary to do the planning and resiliency work that we need to do across the city to ensure that our communities, ecosystems, workers, infrastructure, and businesses withstand the impacts of climate change. Wildfires, extreme heat, smoke, bad air days, extreme rain, flooding, and landslides are all a part of our reality now. We have to plan for it. We need to prioritize and resource this work across the city for BPS, PBOT, PBEM, and several other bureaus to be able to meet the needs of our community and put us on track for meeting our carbon reduction goals. My call to action today is that if you're serious about acting on climate and resiliency protections and doing it in a community-centered way, we need to prioritize climate in our budgeting, programming, capital investments, and policy development. And we need to find new ways to fund this work that shares the responsibilities with those that are responsible for these climate impacts. General fund resources will not meet the needs of the work ahead. We need new ways to fund this work, and those that emit carbon pollution need to be a part of the solution. Next slide, Andrea. The Climate Emergency Declaration also makes explicit the intersections of climate change, systemic racism, economic disparities, and health inequities. If anything, the extreme heat event exposed these disparities very clearly when the temperature in Lentz hit 124 degrees and was 9 degrees hotter than the city's average. That is in part because of the disparities in tree canopy across the city. Tree canopy on the west side of the city is 54%, while only 20% on the east side. These are disparities that are solvable. Climate justice means that climate work is not just about reducing carbon emissions. It's about ensuring communities most directly impacted also benefit. It's about thinking more holistically, so when we're developing a climate policy, we're engaging with community about the opportunities to create jobs, economic opportunities, wealth generation, and reduce cost burdens. It is about shifting and sharing power and resources with those who've historically not had it. Last spring, City Council passed a resolution that called for the city to prioritize racial equity and climate in our recovery from the pandemic and slowed economy. Elevating equity and climate is leadership, and we need your help to make sure these commitments are prioritized and your bureaus are resourced to do the work. And now I'll turn this to Andrea Jacob, who leads our climate program for BPS, to share more specifically about where we're at in terms of meeting our carbon reduction goals, the work that we've accomplished this past year with our current level of resources, as well as other work underway and priorities ahead. Thanks.
Thank you, Andrea. Good afternoon, Mayor and Commissioners. My name is Andrea Jacob. I use she, her pronouns, and I manage climate policy and programs for BPS. One of the key things that the declaration does is establish the city's most current carbon emissions reduction targets. We need to reach a 50% reduction by 2030, that's 8.5 years away, and 100% reduction by 2050. These are the targets that are in line with the best available science and with the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. As of 2018, our most current carbon inventory year, though we are hard at work on the 2019 inventory, Portland is down 19% in total emissions over our 1990 baseline. Now, while this seems like good news, and it is, it's not the full picture. Over the last few years, reductions have plateaued, and as you'll hear about in a moment from PBOT, transportation emissions are on the rise. At the current trajectory of reductions, action, and investment, we are not on track to reach our goals. In fact, you can see that we'll miss them by a wide margin. So we need to make some big moves very soon. But we should take a moment to acknowledge that in a year unlike any other, there were accomplishments. Staff and community partners persevered through unimaginable obstacles to move forward on a few of the very specific directives in the declaration. We were directed to work with youth and stakeholders to develop a climate test to ensure that city bureaus account for carbon in their decision-making. In December 2020, City Council adopted an internal cost of carbon for city operations. The internal cost of carbon applies to some specific bureaus and decision processes. It is a shadow price, not a hard financial fee. We developed this policy in the midst of COVID when the city's revenue picture was so dire that we felt we needed to take a slower and more evaluative pilot approach. But we consider this a first step toward implementation of a broader climate test. And while implementation has been slow to take off due to staff vacancy, this is a priority for us for the next fiscal year. As has been noted, the declaration leads off by resolving the city to advance climate justice and directs BPS to work closely with other city bureaus, Multnomah County, frontline communities, and youth-led organizations to establish and co-convene a new and ongoing climate justice initiative. Over the last year, this has taken shape as Climate Justice by Design. Led by community partners and supported by BPS in Multnomah County, we are creating a third space to co-create intersectional and innovative climate justice solutions that center the experience and voices of frontline communities. In a little bit, you'll hear more about this work from some of our invited guests. On December 12, 2020, more than 150 youth convened for a day-long summit organized by Black, Indigenous, and youth of color to inform and empower themselves to center climate justice and wellness in their futures. One of our invited guests will be speaking to this in a little bit as well. And shouting out to our colleagues at PBOT, they built several Rose Lane projects and more are in progress, including transit priority lanes and spot improvements to make buses and streetcar more reliable and faster for riders. There were many other things that city staff and partners accomplished, and I don't have time to detail them today, but I encourage you to put on your reading glasses and please review the appendix at the back of the report where you'll find updates on every single one of the directives in the declaration. And I would like to quickly acknowledge the amazing work of my incredible staff on the BPS climate team, my BPS planning colleagues, and many more colleagues at Parks, PBOT, BES, Water, PBEM, OMF, and Fire. While we're proud of what we've accomplished, we are sobered by how much further we have to go. We want to take some time to preview what the big moves for the climate are and where we'll need your support in the coming months. Some of these actions were underway over the last year too, so I don't mean to imply that no work on these actions has been done or that we're starting from ground zero, but they are still in process and advancing. Together, these moves put our 2030 goals within reach, but only if we fully commit politically and financially. Our decarbonization pathways analysis shows that there is no single one action or even two or three that get us to the 2050 reduction targets. We have to eliminate carbon from every sector of the economy. That means buildings, transportation, energy supply, and industry. Making our grid, our electric grid, 100% clean and emissions-free is a major priority. BPS proudly stood behind an incredibly talented and dedicated frontline, community-led, statewide coalition to help push the 100% clean bill through this legislature this past session. And Governor Brown signed this into law this week. This bill does many things, including establishing a goal for the electric utilities to supply emissions-free power by 2040, and putting in place some of the strongest labor and apprenticeship provisions ever included in a 100% clean law. It also provides for multi-million dollar investments in community-based renewables, which is an important city priority since 2017 when we passed the 100% renewable energy resolution. Importantly for the city, the bill creates a pathway for us to work with PGE and Pacific Power to develop programs and products that enable us to meet the declaration's goal of 100% clean electricity by 2030, a full 10 years sooner than the state. Implementation of this bill in partnership with community will be a major work priority for BPS over the next couple of years. To reach carbon reduction targets, we must address emissions from our buildings, from the built environment. In the report, we highlight the work of the Build Shift community team, which has been working diligently to develop a roadmap and recommendations for a net zero carbon building sector. Build Shift is a BIPOC-led team working closely with BPS to center the priorities and lived experience of renters in building policy development. And you'll hear more about this work from one of our invited guests. Replacing fossil diesel fuel with renewable fuels in the transportation sector is another critical strategy we must undertake in the near term to reach our goals. Last year, BPS commissioned stakeholder research and analysis and is starting a stakeholder process now through the end of the summer. And you'll be hearing more from us on this over the coming months. We're also working with the stakeholder group to understand decarbonization pathways for the industrial and institutional sectors, and we'll have a policy for your consideration later this year. These emissions are the single biggest point sources of carbon and air pollution in the city and must be addressed alongside buildings, energy, and transportation. Finally, we must focus on expanding and enabling electric vehicle charging infrastructure throughout our building stock. Our efforts here took a major step forward in the legislative session with the passage of House Bill 2180, which requires that all new commercial development in the state and all new multifamily housing with five or more units have the electrical capacity and conduit to install EV charging in 20% or more parking spaces. And while this is a major step forward, we still will need to address the parts of the building stock that this bill doesn't cover. So with that, I would like to hand it off to Art Pierce from PBOT, who will take us on a deeper dive into transportation emissions and decarbonization.
Thank you, Andrea. Good afternoon, Council. Art Pierce, Policy Planning and Projects Group Director here at PBOT. And so as Andrea has indicated earlier, transportation continues to be one of our more challenging sectors for reducing emissions. Portland's transportation emissions are up 6% from 1990. So if you look at the trend line here on the screen, you'll see that we have to radically change course to successfully meet our 2030 target or the 2050 target even farther out. Next slide, Andrew. PBOT is organizing our key strategies to advance transportation and climate justice now into a triangle shape that connects together our current initiatives for planning and building and expanding the uses of the right-of-way and the way we offer mobility services together with clean fuels and vehicles and the sort of person-based activities that we're now thinking of as software that might reduce the vehicle miles traveled experienced by individual Portlanders. This is key in terms of the way we shift pricing and policy and regulations and the incentives that we give individual Portlanders to help all of us in terms of reducing our emissions. And this is, it can be a very challenging thing for people to adapt their day-to-day lives. All of these are organized around our overall principle of designing for transportation justice and working towards the unfortunate need for us to move towards adaption and preparation for resiliency, because we are shifting at this point and need to be moving towards reduction of 50% by 2030. Next slide, Andrea. It is also possible that reducing vehicle miles travels can create a triple win for climate, equitable access, and for safety. By shifting our policies, our pricing programs, and our incentives, we can reduce the vehicle miles travels and emissions supporting climate. We can reinvest revenues coming from those pricing mechanisms to improve access and mobility. And these investments and the reduction of reliance on the automobile can improve safety and save lives throughout the Portland area. Next slide, Andrew. We have highlighted five key moves that we see as near-term opportunities for PBOT and the city to make progress. The first, focusing on pricing and reinvesting for equitable mobility, was the major focus of an 18-month-long pricing options for equitable mobility task force, which will be coming and bringing its final recommendations to City Council later on this fall. Second, we continue to need to be able to revise key policies to make sure that they're aligned with our goals. A good example of that is how we currently measure traffic mobility based on the number of motor vehicles moved rather than the number of people served by our transportation system. Third, we need to be continuing to regulate demand through efforts like managing parking supply and demand, and using those systems to reinvest and provide more options, such as the transportation wallet that has been so successful in our parking districts. Fourth, we need to continue to, with ardence, reallocate and activate our rights of way. This continues to be a high priority, adding cycling and pedestrian facilities, continuing with the Roseland initiatives, and shifting into pedestrianized plazas and public spaces to help people enjoy our rights of way in a more healthy and climate sensitive manner. And then last, number fifth, we need to continue to support the electrification of our transportation system through creating additional charging in our centers and corridors that helps to complement the bike share and scooter systems that are electric currently to be able to support a climate neutral transportation system. Next slide. I think it's back to you, Andrea. Yep.
Thank you, Art. Yeah. So 2030 is 8.5 years away, the amount of time we have to cut our emissions in half or more. And unless we accelerate solutions, we're not going to make it. We've done many of the easy steps and have made real progress, but the next steps, decarbonizing buildings, transportation, and industry, these steps are more challenging. It will require leadership and collaborations, a willingness to challenge business as usual and political opposition, and instead accelerate change. All the while, we must walk the talk by prioritizing and centering climate change and equity in our own budgets, operations, investments, and decision-making. Our bureaus are not resourced, as we've talked about, to deliver the actions that are called for in the Climate Emergency Declaration, let alone the additional work that we need to undertake. The more hopeful news is that we have the opportunity to build back better and create a more equitable city. Portland is home to so many creative people willing to work together, take risks, and think differently about solutions. We have the opportunity of federal funding coming soon that we shouldn't miss. So I'd like to shift now to our invited guests who are here to speak about their work and their experiences with some of the projects and policies identified in the Climate Emergency Declaration. And I'd like to thank them for their time and their partnership. We will start with Vivian Satterfield from Verde.
Thank you very much, Director Durbin, and thank you, Mayor and Commissioners, for this opportunity to speak with you this afternoon. My name is Vivian Satterfield, and I have the privilege of working on behalf of Verde. I was invited today to actually come share some of my experience working with PBOT and the staff on the pricing options for equitable mobility, but I would be remiss if I didn't take the opportunity as the opening speaker on this panel to share some of my thoughts, observations, and connection to this climate justice work. It's deeply personal, I know, for all of us. We're all impacted in different ways. I'm the only member of my family that lives in the United States. The rest of my family lives in Malaysia. They live in China. They live in Taiwan. They live in areas that we like to think are more directly impacted by climate change. And yet, I fielded calls all year from them so concerned about me, their only US-based family member, about what we have experienced. And they know I do environmental justice work. So, you know, in the decade plus that I have been an environmental justice advocate, I have to share that the problem statements have really changed very little. We are still continuing to invest in infrastructure that prioritizes the speed and efficacy of auto movement over the safety of a person crossing the street to reach a bus stop. We allow industrial and institutional polluters to skirt taxes and fees and pollute our air and dump hazards into our land in pursuit of profit. And so while we ourselves may not have voted on the measures nor signed the legislation, we have allowed the perpetuation of the status quo. The systems that we've made these sacrifices for generation after generation have shown time and time again that it's a failure. And the people who pay the biggest price are again and again, the Black, Indigenous, and other people of color, immigrants, and people living with disabilities in communities that have low economic wealth. And so if we're going to choose to take on the task of examining what a different way of doing things might be, we have to commit ourselves to seeing it through. We have to be willing to wield the power we have and choose a desired future state, because the reality is that change needs to come faster and bigger. So as much as it's satisfying to make some progress, this can't just be some painted bus lanes here and there, or another study group whose recommendations get squashed by big business at the 11th hour of passage. We need a commitment to creating a transportation network that charges some drivers more. And I'm glad that we've made some recommendations in the pricing options for equitable mobility that will be coming forward in council later this year. And we need a commitment to tackling politically tricky issues like mandating that all sectors of the economy need to pay for their climate impacts. And we need to put our collective muscle behind holding other levels of government accountable to our climate goals. And that's because the reality that uncomfortable, long-lasting change is already happening to us. And of course, it's hitting the most vulnerable people the hardest. You know, there's a pervasive belief that the world's poor will act as a shield for climate disasters. Yet where has more disasters struck than right here at home? We're living in an age of wildfires and heat waves and ice storms. You know, Council, you know I'm not known for being hyperbolic or alarmist. So I hope to impart upon you the call to be brave and make big, difficult decisions and changes now, upfront, strategically, and making sure that the benefits and burdens are distributed equitably. We need to build better, healthier, safer, more accessible, more equitable, more resilient systems that can mitigate and adapt to this uncertain and fragile future. I do have some good news for you, because fortunately there's a dedicated base of folks who have voluntarily taken a first crack at identifying policies that you can further refine and enact. Community-based organizations like Verde have been stepping up in recent years to lead on climate. There's a beautiful photo that was shown earlier in the presentation. I was so proud to be a part of OPAL when we organized the 2017 People's Climate March. We've secured a new source of revenue here at the city through the Portland Clean Energy Community Benefits Fund. We've crafted and pushed for groundbreaking legislation at the state level, which sets real and attainable targets for decarbonizing our energy grid. And And we are crafting transportation solutions and not shying away from the tough stuff, like how we raise transportation revenue. So in my closing words, I just want to say that despite everything, I organize and I continue to do this work. It comes from a deep place of love and a very deep well, apparently, of hope. I have to have hope that we have all the tools we need to save ourselves. And council members, you're an essential means to that end. Thank you for your work and thank you, staff.
Thank you, Vivian. Next, we'll hear from Dr. Melanie Plout from 350 PDX. Dr. Plout.
Good afternoon, Mayor and Commissioners. My name is Dr. Melanie Plout, she, her pronouns, please. I'm a volunteer with, and today representing 350 PDX. For the past 8 years, 350 PDX has been working to help build the local grassroots climate justice movement. We work to address the causes of the climate crisis through justice-based solutions. Reflecting on the current report, we strongly support the important community-led work being done, including the Climate Justice Initiative and the Build Shift policy development. But in the few minutes that we have with you today, we must call out some important issues where there has not been progress and where there are actions that you, Council, must take to help mitigate our climate emergency. We have four requests. First, engage the community more about the climate emergency for transparency, for community input, for accountability, and for greater action. The first directive in the declaration calls on Portlanders to work together on this existential threat. This is the first progress report after more than a year, and we are a little concerned about the level of engagement and notification to the public about this report. We don't have to remind you that the community cares deeply about the climate, especially after last month's heat dome that killed 71 people in Multnomah County alone. And before that, in September 2019, over 20,000 people filled the streets of downtown Portland, joining 7 million around the world in a global climate strike. The young people who went on school strike then to demand action were the ones who helped lead the city to declare a climate emergency. Second, and critically for this council, fund the climate emergency work. The declaration states a need for, quote, an immediate mobilization effort initiating greater action and resources, but it had no funding attached to it. And in the 13 months since it's passed, we've yet to see sufficient resources allocated for this emergency, neither in last year's or this year's budget process. The lack of investment guarantees that the necessary work can't happen and that harms to our city and to frontline communities are perpetuated. Third, so-called renewable natural gas does not belong in any climate emergency plan. Like fracked gas, RNG is still methane, one of the most potent causes of global warming. RNG is often touted by the gas industry as a green fuel that one day will replace the fracked gas used in our homes and buildings currently. However, a 2018 report by Oregon's Department of Energy found that RNG could replace at most 1/5 of the state's current gas use. For it to be even a small part of the solution requires technology that's currently not operational in the US. The exaggeration of the potential of this fuel is the gas industry's political and marketing strategy as they fight for their lives to allow it to continue to expand its pipes and other infrastructure and lock us into a future of fossil fuel use. It's imperative that the city not fall for the gas industry's greenwashing and bending of the truth. So we need this council to acknowledge that RNG is not the answer and will not enable Northwest Natural to fully decarbonize their gas pipeline system. Lastly, stop fossil fuel infrastructure expansion. Specifically, stop Zenith Energy from handling crude oil in Northwest Portland. Mayor and commissioners, for over 3 years, you're probably tired of us. You've heard from the public calling on you to stop these dangerous and climate destroying operations. Most recently, you received a letter signed by the Linton Neighborhood Association and 45 other community organizations demanding action to stop the transportation and storage of crude oil by Zenith. Yet in these past 3 years, the amount of toxic crude oil in mile-long trains traveling through Portland neighborhoods and along the Columbia River Gorge and Willamette River has increased by 200 million gallons. The danger that Zenith poses to our community, our river, our land, and our climate is unacceptable. We're counting on you to do the right thing. Say no to Zenith by denying the land use compatibility statement. There's much more to say and many more people you should be hearing from. Portland alone cannot solve the climate crisis, but we must do everything we can as fast as we can to do our part to rapidly bring down emissions, to redress harms, injustices, and inequities, and to develop adaptation and resilient plans for all of us. To quote the youth, our house is on fire. Act like it. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Dr. Plout. Next, we'll hear from Shauna Brownstein from PGE.
Hi, thank you so much for having me, inviting me to present to this council. My name is Shauna Brownstein, and I am the Climate and Communities Manager at Portland General Electric. And I just want to apologize in advance. I have a cold, so if I cough, it might take me a moment. So for 130 years, PGE has provided our communities with safe, reliable, and affordable electricity. Today, we are proud to be leading the way to cleaner energy for Oregon's future. We've set bold goals to mitigate greenhouse gas emissions, including electrifying 60% of our fleet vehicles by 2030, which is the boldest in the nation. We aim to reduce greenhouse gas emissions associated with the power we serve to customers by at least 80% by 2030, and intend to achieve the new House Bill 2021 target of zero greenhouse emissions associated with the power we serve to customers by 2040. We also understand the importance of centering environmental justice communities and empowering all our customers to reduce their emissions and to do so in an equitable way. We've incorporated an equity lens into our stakeholder engagement processes, market research, and products. We understand that PGE delivers an essential service that plays a critical role in the vitality of our communities. We must continue to transform our energy system in an inclusive manner that addresses disparities head on. This is a serious commitment, and we embrace our role in connecting all energy resources, partners, and customers with a truly integrated grid. This commitment extends to our community partners as well. We are thrilled to be partnering with the City of Portland on many meaningful and innovative activities and actions that help drive down emissions and create a resilient and equitable modernized electricity grid. For example, we are piloting utility pole mounted chargers in the right of way in Southeast Portland. We've installed two Electric Avenue charging centers, one in East Portland and one downtown. And we utilize the nation's first smart grid test bed in North Portland to introduce innovative new programs and services to residents and businesses. Today, I'm pleased to share some of our larger partnerships and projects with you. These focus on our transportation electrification work with the city. I'll be happy to share additional information about partnerships in other areas and ways we are working with our customers at a later date if you're interested. The first example I'd like to share of this partnership is a recent joint PBOT PGE grant application for $6.5 million to the Department of Energy to expand EV charging in Portland's right of way. If funded, this project will install over 100 EV chargers in Portland's underserved communities, so folks who rent their homes, live in multifamily buildings, or who do not have access to off-street parking may enjoy the benefits of electric vehicles. Any infrastructure deployment would be paired with robust community listening sessions, as well as engagement and education around the financial and environmental benefits of EVs. As part of this grant, we will also electrify 150 Lyft vehicles, 40 free-to-move car share vehicles, and 5 wheelchair-accessible taxi cabs. PGE and Pacific Core both provided significant financial match to this grant. PSU will be the research lead, and Community Energy Project will be in the lead on community outreach. Finally, PBOT demonstrated leadership, and BPS made meaningful contributions to this grant. PBOT, in particular, will be an equal implementing partner. We will find out in October if we will receive the funding, and I look forward to reporting back to this council. Another example of our partnership is PGE's assessment of the city's entire fleet with a lens towards cost-effective electrification. We worked with the city to look at which vehicles were cost-effective to replace with EVs, and based on where those vehicles reside, we prioritized which locations should be electrified first, and what the associated cost savings might be. Based on these results, we believe the city is well positioned to start electrifying 720 vehicles, representing 32% of the city's entire fleet. Doing so would result in significant savings from reduced fuel and maintenance costs, which could offset our charging infrastructure costs and reduce fleet CO2 emissions by over 2,000 metric tons annually. Additionally, we are currently working to install EV charging infrastructure at 3 city sites in PGE's territory. There are other examples, including PGE's participation in the Bureau of Planning Sustainability's EV Ready Code project, where we provide input on requiring new construction, especially multifamily buildings, to include EV ready infrastructure, and our regional fleet coordination work, where BPS and PGE staff have co-convened regular conversations among local organizations, municipalities, city fleet, and private companies with large fleets to share electrification learnings like accessing incentives, understanding revenue generation opportunities from the state's clean fuels program, and exploring shared charging infrastructure options. Thank you again for the opportunity to share these achievements with you today. They would not have been possible without the city's leadership and the excellent staff of the city bureaus. We look forward to building on these innovative partnerships to ensure that Portland and Oregon's clean energy future is secure. Thank you.
Thank you, Shauna. Next, we'll hear from Amy Henriksen, who's with the Portland Youth Climate Council. Amy.
Thank you, mayors, commissioner, and everyone here today. My name is Amy Henriksen. I use she, her pronouns. I'm a rising junior at Lincoln High School, and I'm representing Portland Youth Climate Council. When I sat down to begin writing this testimony, I asked myself, why is it that what I might say is important? Why is my voice as a 16-year-old a valuable one? In further thinking, I answered my own question. The summary section of the progress report states, the next several years are critical if we are to meet Portland's climate goals. Initially, I didn't think anything of it, but my mind came back to if we are to meet Portland's climate goals, if, how can we write about the possibility of not meeting these goals? How can we envision a future in which we do not fulfill these objectives? I will not accept anything less than what our city has agreed to. I will not allow myself, my friends, younger kids, or any youth be let down by those meant to protect us. Although I read the report in full, I didn't need to see the whole thing to know that we haven't done enough. While I applaud everyone who has tirelessly worked to achieve the goals of the Climate Emergency Declaration, there hasn't been enough effort from the city to execute all that the CED says we must accomplish. There are a number of concrete goals within this report that, frankly, I'm surprised we haven't already carried out. The year-round Climate Pass for Youth is a Climate Emergency Declaration commitment. While I know this conversation was limited by the failed metro measure, it is still something the city committed to in the CED and youth have advocated for decades. Additionally, it is tangible actions like this that will not only benefit youth in Portland and reduce carbon emissions, but will also complete one more item on the comprehensive checklist of the Climate Emergency Declaration. I know that this year has been extremely difficult for many reasons. Believe me, I've lived through it. Online school, little social interaction, losing friends, just as much as you all have. And while I understand that it can be very challenging to make change in a strained world, this work is not going to get any easier. Even through the pandemic, there has been extreme weather of all kinds, snow and heat, wildfires, floods, not to mention death caused by these events. Just 2 days ago, I was sent an article from The Guardian titled, "Video shows salmon injured by unlivable water temperatures after heat wave." Why is it that I'm not even surprised to see such things? We've come to a point where we're desensitized to ecological destruction and terror. I don't want to live this way. I don't want to feel such a lack of empathy for other beings just because I now expect their demise. In the words of the progress report, there's no time to waste. I couldn't agree more. With the amount of time we've already spent not taking action, I expect the city to fully commit themselves to the Climate Emergency Declaration this coming year. This means more people focused on its goals from across bureaus. This means legitimate funding to make clean energy transitions. This means a focus on climate impacts in every single decision, no matter the size. I believe that we can make a difference if we commit to these goals. but I don't have the power to do this. So what I ask of you, Mayor and Commissioners, is to extensively prioritize these goals so there are fewer pieces to pick up in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Amy. Next, we'll hear from Kaya LaGuardia Yanamina. Kaya from Apano.
Hello, thank you, Mayor and Commissioners and everyone here today. My name is Kaya LaGuardia Yanamina. I go by she, her pronouns, and I'm here with the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon, or Apano, both as a representative, but also a community member that has participated in Apano spaces for the past 7 years. I am a recent graduate from Roosevelt High School in North Portland, and a proud Uchinanchu, or Indigenous Okinawan and Afro-Cuban woman in this space. I would like to talk about the Climate Justice by Design project specifically and my reflections throughout doing this work. When I first entered the Climate Justice by Design space, it was during the introductory youth workshops where we discussed the importance of design framing and asking the right questions to get the right results. So this was very eye-opening to me because, for example, while the US governmental system doesn't benefit marginalized communities, it's working the way that it was designed to function. So with this idea of structures in mind, the Climate Justice by Design process prioritizes flipping the script and recreating our community-grounded approach to climate justice, having the chance to design our own process towards climate action between government and community members. So phase one of cohort meeting consisted of structural suggestions, and phase two focused on narrowing down the actual climate-related issues that we were going to address. We started with the how, and we'll soon address the what, basically. I really appreciate the commitment to centering by POC, or Black Indigenous People of Color, and frontline voices in this project. Community members actually co-creating the process instead of being looped into the process down the line has been impactful to valuing communities' voices in Portland. In phase one, our facilitators purposely held a space where agency and government people actually weren't in the room and allowed for honest reflection as community members in identifying different experiences we had when we entered the Climate Justice by Design space. The idea of a space for solidarity and recognizing differences is essential when we're creating this third space, or an area that allows a middle ground for community and government to build connections. So for me, as a woman who comes from island roots, climate justice and protecting home is everything to my community. And I feel grateful to have the chance to work with the city of Portland and really trying to pave the way to prioritize centering those community voices and working towards deeper community resilience. Lastly, I wanted to highlight the amount of time and dedication that each of our members have contributed to this space. We had lots of discussion about the process of inviting other governmental figures while still allowing that co-creation and how we would go about it. Climate Justice by Design values not just the outcome, but also the methods of getting there and not rushing to achieve the right result. So this design and climate action really couldn't be done without the time, dedication, and hard work of each of our members. And I really appreciate everyone's contribution to our work so far. So those are my experiences from the Climate Justice by Design project specifically. Thank you, Mayor and Commissioners, for holding this space. And we look forward to continuing climate justice work in our city and just reimagining what climate action could look like for us. So yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much, Kaya, and thank you for participating in that process. Our next and final speaker is Taryn Evans from the Coalition of Communities of Color. Taryn.
Yeah, good afternoon, Mr. Mayor and Commissioners. My name is Taryn Evans. I'm here today representing the Coalition of Communities of Color. The CCC supports a collective racial justice effort to improve outcomes for communities of color through policy analysis and advocacy, culturally appropriate data and research, and leadership development in communities of color. I remember when this declaration was adopted a year ago, we talked about the unprecedented moment that we were in. And in the midst of a global pandemic and racial justice uprisings throughout the country, we talked about how we could not continue with business as usual or go back to normal, and that new, bold, and innovative solutions were needed to meet the moment that we were in. What we all did not know at that moment was what would come over the course of the next year. Several months after this declaration was adopted, some of the worst wildfires in recent history spread across the state. We were shuttered in our homes, for those of us fortunate enough to have homes, not only due to the pandemic, but due to extremely hazardous air quality. On September 13, 2020, Portland, Oregon had the worst air quality of any major city in the world, due to wildfire smoke blanketing the city. On February 15, 2021, due to an ice storm, over 330,000 Oregonians were without power, the largest number of outages in Oregon's recorded history. On June 28, 2021, the temperature in Portland reached 116 degrees, breaking the record of the previous day's high of 112 degrees, breaking the record of the previous day's high of 108 degrees. However, this is about more than a set of shocking statistics. It's about the lived experience of those most acutely affected by the climate crisis. Black, Indigenous, people of color, and low-income communities disproportionately bear the burden of this crisis. I think of the stories that I've heard from community members over the course of this past year. The stories of people sick from wildfire smoke, people desperate for air purifiers because the air quality in their homes was hardly any better than the air quality outside. People without access to air conditioning, sick from the heat. We need to center the most impacted. Their stories and experiences should guide us in the development of solutions. This involves a fundamental restructuring of the way that things have been done in the past and shifting power. I'm proud to be involved in several projects that I feel are doing just that. The first project that I'll mention is work that CCC is engaged with, along with several other community-based organizations and community leaders. And that project is Building Community and Shifting Power, or Build Shift. This work is an outgrowth of the Zero Cities Project, an effort to equitably decarbonize the building sector in the city of Portland. Our team focuses on buildings and energy, but in a way that centers community wisdom and lived experience. We recognize that technical expertise is only one aspect, and that community members who are experiencing the worst impacts of the climate crisis are experts in their own right. 2 weeks ago, we hosted several community workshops. One of the activities that stuck out to me was a visioning exercise that we did. We asked participants to imagine the world in 2050. What would the world look like? What sort of systems did people imagine would be in place? Overwhelmingly, people agreed that they would like to see a radically different world and systems that valued people and the environment and that were not rooted in greed and exploitation. However, there was also feedback that it was difficult to imagine this world to be because for so long we've continued to do things the same way and experience the same inequitable outcomes. The gulf between the present reality and our aspirations for the future can be daunting. Sometimes it can be hard to imagine a more just and equitable world because of how much we know needs to change for us to get there. But that is also why this work is urgent. The second project that I'll mention is Climate Justice by Design. This project brings together government and community to co-create climate justice strategies that center the experiences of frontline communities. This work is fundamentally based on the idea that in order to get to more just outcomes, we need to focus on the process itself. Processes must start with community at the onset, rather than government determining solutions and bringing in community to consult on predetermined pathways. Both Climate Justice by Design and Build Shift are examples of new and innovative initiatives that reframe traditional power relationships between government and community. We must all work together with our respective strengths and resources to deal with the climate crisis and the host of other crises that we face. But we need to learn to work together in new ways to challenge the familiar processes, patterns, and mindsets that got us to the moment that we are in. Because ultimately, this is about all of our lives, the generations to come, and the more just future that we all must collectively create. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Taryn, very much for your partnership. So Mayor, Commissioners, that is our invited panel. And Commissioner Rubio, I will turn it back to you.
Thank you, Director Durbin. And thank you to Taryn, Amy, Vivian, Dr. Plout, Shauna, and Kaya for sharing your experiences and the priorities of this work with us today. What's clear is that we need to be aligned and in our partnership, in our fight against climate change in all the ways we can from every angle and using every lever that we can. And that's why it's so important to have the wisdom and voices of the community drive and lead this work. And I'm very excited for the Climate by Design, Climate Justice by Design work. Government must learn how to shift power to community with government bringing our role, leverage, and support to bear.
We've done a lot together and the city has learned a lot, but the hard work remains. And I'm grateful that we have community partners that hold us accountable. This concludes our presentation for today, Mayor Wheeler. So I will hand it back to you.
Very good, colleagues. Before I jump in here, Commissioner Mapps.
I have a question, I think, for staff. If it's easy to do, can we pull up the slide that shows the, I think, reduction in greenhouse or carbon emissions in Portland over time? Just looks like a line sloping down and projecting into the future. Maybe, sure. So I guess one of my questions is, is this Portland specific? This must be Portland specific.
It's the Multnomah County. So we do this data collection for the county and we do our work in partnership with the county for planning.
Do we have, I'm glad to see the progress that we made from, I assume, I don't know when this graph starts, maybe 1990 to 2018. Do we understand what variables are bringing this down? What did we do right in the last two decades that actually helped us here? And it also strikes me as being kind of counterintuitive because I think Art showed us a sign or a graph which showed emissions from vehicles in Portland started. And since 1990, our emissions from vehicles has gone up, but we seem to be down 19%. So what's driving these numbers? Do we know?
Yeah, I'll take a shot at that, Commissioner. This is a fairly stylized view, not super detailed. We do publish the full emissions inventory on the BPS website, and where you can see with more granularity over the last few years, something that looks more like this. And so where we've actually done fairly well is in the energy, the electric grid. We have brought down the carbon intensity just by bringing more renewables onto the grid and over time. And also we've had Energy Trust of Oregon in the mix for a long time, adding incentives into the market for people to make their homes more energy efficient and things like that. So in the buildings and energy side, we have seen that has really helped bring down that curve. But when you really start breaking it out by sector, and this is in our inventory report, you can see that not all the sectors are doing the same thing. And so the transportation sector is the one sector that really is over our 1990 baseline. And so that's why we're really focusing there. It's not that we are done on buildings and energy. We certainly have a long way to go, but we have been at it in those sectors for relatively longer. So I think that's part of the detail here is not really being shown, but I'm happy to share that more detailed report after the hearing.
That would be great. And thank you for that explanation. I might have another couple of questions, but I'd like to give my colleagues a chance too.
Colleagues, any other questions? If not, I'll entertain a motion. Commissioner Ryan?
Yeah, thank you, first of all. That was a wonderful presentation. And I'm glad that Commissioner Mapps had that one slide come up. But Andrea, I'd like to hear that there's one that's a little more detailed. But that was a beautiful graphic. I am curious about something when I was looking at that graphic and the detail one will show that. When we were in the beginning of COVID, there was one thing we were appreciating was how clean the air appeared when the traffic went down for a few months or 6 months or whatever. Clearly that's not happening anymore. And you really did experience cleaner air. So will we be able to see that in this new updated dense report, do you think?
So one of the challenges is that our inventory lags a little bit because we're reliant on data from the federal government. So while our next update will be 2019, and then in a year from now, we'll be at 2020. So it is a little bit frustrating to not be able to have it in real time. But we are looking forward, I guess, to see what the data are from 2020. And I think it will look really different from the past several years. So yeah, we're a little ways out from being able to see what that actually looked like.
Yeah, that will hopefully be inspiring. It is a drag when data from government sources is so lagging. It's a big issue in a lot of sectors. So I'm sure you're doing all you can to try to make it more current. I think for me, I was really taken with all the testimony. It was great. So it's probably about, I love mixing in people that don't usually sit at the same table, because I think that's the only way you really create change. And so I did notice you had someone from PGE. Are we engaging with others in industries? I heard you mention Pacific or Northwest Natural Gas. Are they at any of these tables?
Yes.
Okay, yes,
we just happen to have a stronger, I think, more developed partnership with Portland General Electric, but we definitely engage with the other utilities as well.
Okay, that's good to hear. And then why I'm on that, why we're having this report and I can focus on it, communities of faith, are they involved at any of the tables, since that's becoming a real justice issue for a lot of communities of faith? And that really gets at the grassroots too.
I am aware that we've had more engagement with the faith community on our planning and land use side, and I might give it over to Andrea Durbin to answer that. I think maybe a little bit less on our decarbonization work, and Art, if you have anything to say about that, please jump in. But thank you for that point. I think we're always looking to broaden our engagement and our tables.
Yeah. Hi, Art.
Hello, I think we've had some historic engagement in transportation processes through Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon and their climate focus, but I don't recall a recent engagement, so I think that's a great suggestion for us to reach out and sort of reactivate that connection.
Yeah, I know we have a reputation for being unchurched, but we're not unspiritual and we also have aspirations. So you definitely want to engage, I think, with those communities. All right, let me see. And when we think of since transportation is such a big part of this, I think on the industry side, what transportation industries are involved in addition to PBOT at the tables? We know Keith Wilson's company is well known for their activism. So I guess I want to hear, is Titan involved, or what's the name of his company? Are they involved in any of the tables? Any of our trucking companies?
Go ahead, Shauna. Yeah.
So Commissioner Ryan, one of the groups that BPS and PGE co-convenes is around regional fleet electrification. And there are several private companies at the table there, including Daimler, Titan, and others. I'm happy to get you a full list. The port is also at the table there, as are other surrounding Portland metro areas and services.
No, hearing Daimler in the port, that just makes so much sense. So this is good. We're not going to, get a crack at this if we keep it just within the community organizations and government. And then I also was thinking about the large entertainment venues, just because they attract so many vehicles at once. And so I don't know how they're engaged. And getting people to obviously bike to Timber and Thorns matches, I don't even know what that looks like. I just assume that you guys are having dialogue about such things.
For sure. And that's a very active partnership with the Timbers and Thorns and with MODA, working towards incenting participants and to be using a whole variety of modes, transit, walking, and cycling, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, we have to, public health in all of our brains, especially with the rise in the Delta variant. But the fact is we want connection. And then we also, we want to gather in these big venues, but we have to acknowledge what a strain that puts on the environment at the same time. So how do we manage that? I put all these out not as someone with solutions. I just, because you're giving this report and I get to focus on it right now, I wanted to toss out some other ways to do that cross-sector engagement. And I really think that all Portlanders can get behind this if we all continue to focus on what the goal is. And clearly we're not making enough progress. And I really love that you were honest about the 40% is where we're gonna land at this current rate. I think you have to be really explicit about that type of data, because it's so easy to rest on the laurels of the vision and the proclamation, but it doesn't mean much if in fact our targets are way off. So just keep being blunt about where we really are, so we don't find ourselves 10 years from the goal and wonder, and we won't do that silly thing where then government will just move the goalpost or have a whole new table set to have another proclamation. So, you know, we have to stop the fits and starts of proclamations and goal setting and just be honest, like you were when you said 40% is the likely target at this moment. I thought that was one of my favorite parts of the presentation. Anyway, thank you.
Mr. Maps.
I'm not sure if this is a question or if it's a comment, but let me try to phrase it in the form of a question, and it may be as much to staff as it is to my colleagues. I do wonder if we, the City of Portland, are staffed up and organized appropriately for meeting these goals. And one way in which that really kind of came home for me was I was looking at the appendix, which includes about 34 action items on climate, on addressing climate issues. And of those 34, I think 24 were items where BPS was the lead agency. Just seems like an awful lot of, that's a huge responsibility for one relatively small bureau. As the commissioner in charge of both water and environmental services, we appear a couple of places in there. But if we really want to move to a zero emissions economy, it feels to me like we might need more focus, and it should be a broader bureau effort. And if someone has a response to that, that'd be great. If not, we can just let that.
Commissioner, I'm happy to take that. And I think in answer to question, the answer is no, we're not staffed up. We don't have the sufficient resources and capacities. And I think to a large extent, the progress that you've seen is because city staff care so much, and they've just kind of doubled down on their workload to try to get this work done. But I think we are at that critical pass moment, which is we have way more, you know, if we're going to be advancing these solutions that are really big moves that put us on the path to delivering the climate community benefits that we need and meet our reduction goals, we're going to need to prioritize it by funding it and funding capacity, staff positions in bureaus that we need to lead and step in. So at BPS, at PBOT, and a lot of the bureaus that are working on the resiliency work, you know, PBEM is, I think, a great example of a very important bureau in our in the city that is not resourced to do this work, and they really care about this, and they've been doing as much as they can, but we don't have plans in place to respond to the crises that are coming at us.
Well, thank you for that frank assessment, and I do think that this is incredibly important work, and as we just put one budget cycle behind us, in some ways, literally yesterday. But as we move forward, I do hope that this council thinks about how we need to make some different choices in order to, you know, protect the environment.
Good, and I'll chime in here since nobody else has their hand raised at the moment. First of all, colleagues, thank you for your comments and your questions. Great presentations. I wanna thank everybody who took the time to testify. Director Durbin, thank you for putting together, as always, a good presentation, a provocative presentation, and something of a humbling presentation as well, just acknowledging that the work is slow, whereas the need is urgent. And I would encourage you and your team to continue to prioritize those issues that you think are the most important. Come back and let the council know what we need to do and how we need to do it to continue to move forward. Commissioner Rubio, I appreciate you stepping up as the commissioner in charge of the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. You've done a fantastic job, and I just want to acknowledge you and your team going from zero to 100. Lickety split, there really wasn't a lot of time for you to spend onboarding with this important responsibility, but you've taken up the mantle, and I think you've done a fantastic job on behalf of the council and the city at large, and I want to thank you for that.
Thank you, Mayor. And I really want to acknowledge the incredible work of DPS and Director Durbin and her team. You know, they have been working tirelessly in a challenging time on some pretty big issues for our community that are quite literally life or death right now. And so I just want to acknowledge them and give them a lot of appreciation as well.
Absolutely. Thank you, Commissioner. Colleagues, if there's no further questions, I'll entertain a motion.
I move that we accept the report, Mr. Mayor.
Commissioner Mapps moves the report. Can I get a second, please?
Second.
Commissioner Rubio seconds the report. Any further discussion? Keelan, please call the roll.
Mapps.
First of all, I want to thank Commissioner Rubio, her team, and all the panelists today for an excellent presentation. This report could not be more timely as today we are entering yet another heat dome. I'm proud of the progress that the city has made in bringing down our greenhouse gas emissions. But I'm also reminded by your sobering graphs that we have a lot more work to do. I look forward to both revisiting this issue as we come to the next year's budget cycle, and I look forward to meeting with you again a year from now to see and learn about the good work that we're going to get done over the next fiscal year. For these reasons, I vote aye.
Rubio.
I want to thank once again each of our community members who testified and for their presence here today. And I also want to again thank Director Durbin for her leadership here, as well as Andrea Jacob, and also thank Nicoya Phillips and Kyle Deisner, whom I know have contributed to many pieces of this report. It's abundantly clear that climate is no longer just an issue for environmentalists, it's a racial justice issue and one that affects every single one of us. And I wanna reiterate something that I heard today from Director Durbin and our community partners that was very clearly emphasized, which is what Portland does matters everywhere else. And also that climate justice is racial justice. And our fate is a shared one, but our work must be transformational at this point. And we can't succeed as a community if we fail to ensure that frontline communities and the most vulnerable will not be left behind. It's also clear that we haven't yet mobilized the resources and commitments that the Climate Emergency Declaration calls for. And we, as you heard Director Durbin said, we are understaffed to do this work. And I can't underscore this enough. This is not acceptable for where we are at as a community. And we need to act and move forward decisively. And we've made some progress and we have so much further to go. And as a commissioner in charge of BPS, I'm committed to ensuring that as a council, we both prioritize and creatively work together to resource this critical work. And doing our part here at the city within our own budget and in partnership at every level of government and every sector of our economy. All of us need to step up and step forward together. And I look forward to working with my colleagues in the budget process to support this work. In addition to what you've heard about today from our community leaders, we have some pretty big climate policy moves coming up too that BPS and I will be bringing to council in the coming months. From aggressive tree planting in East Portland to working to reduce industrial carbon emissions and improving air quality, decarbonizing buildings, updating the city's renewable fuel standard, and ensuring that finally we ban any further expansion of new fossil fuel infrastructure in Portland's critical energy infrastructure hub, to name a few but important next steps. So I look forward to working with our bureaus and also our community partners to reinvigorate and shape and drive Portland's climate agenda, and also my colleagues as well to work with us do it in a way that's responsible and that's accountable, and also hand in hand with meaningful actions that decarbonize our economy and build a resilient Portland. So I'm very happy to vote aye.
Ryan.
Yes, first of all, I want to begin by thanking Commissioner Rubio for your leadership. You are definitely aligned with your heart and your soul in this one, and it's really obvious. I also want to thank all the community members who participated. I appreciate your stories. They were really helpful. I want to also acknowledge both the Bureau of planning and sustainability, Director Durbin, and your partnership is really clear with PBOT. I think to Commissioner Mapp's point earlier, I think one of what I'd like to see as a part of the council is the more shared responsibility amongst all the bureaus and making this clearly that more of a shared responsibility. And so it does feel a little bit like you're carrying too much weight for what is a citywide goal and a council-wide focus and priority that Commissioner Rubio also spoke to yesterday in a very important meeting that we had about how to spend our emergency dollars. You know, environmental stability for our city residents has long been a value of the city of Portland. And this goes back decades. What I think I've heard once again, though, is how to match those proclamations and those goals with actual action, and more importantly, results. Because sometimes the planning and even the implementation doesn't get you the results you need, so you have to keep adapting. So I think seeing that innovation that is building with these community assets that are coming to the city is what's so important. That's why I was spending a little bit of time my questions about how we knit together the community assets that are out there. This is an all-in, not just within the city bureaus, but within all the community organizations that spoke today, but also hitting those other sectors that sometimes don't sit at the same table. I haven't met anyone that doesn't want clean air, not one person. And so I think that if we always keep focused on those basic goals on where we're going, that will allow us to have the courage to do the right thing as we do behavior change, which is really what's really hard about this, is that adults don't like behavior change. So it's about the behavior change we all need to do within our own households and within organizations and businesses throughout the city, and make Portland really lead and be seen as the city that is on the right track. And I look forward to being a part of a council that has the courage to do what's right. And I'm enthusiastic about supporting today's report. I vote aye.
Wheeler.
I want to share my colleagues' thanks for this presentation. And again, Director Durbin, thank you. Thanks to everybody who participated and testified. This is, as always, a sobering subject. It's one of significant urgency, and it's one where we have to break through bureaucratic inertia that often exists at City Hall. And we want to acknowledge that there has been a number of good moves over the course of the last year. And Director Durbin, I want to acknowledge your leadership, particularly around some of the boring stuff that people don't notice that's really hard and really important. Better housing by design, Central City 2035. Some of those included significant changes to policy and regulations around climate and carbon and reshaping the way our community exists and how we live, and improvements around transportation, and taking what I thought was a very bold and obviously controversial step around increased density in the central city. There weren't a lot of people cheering for us on that one, but I thought it was an important step that we make as a modern city to consolidate our carbon footprint. We expanded our commitments to green roofs. I think at the time we passed our green roof legislation, it was the strongest in the United States. Additionally, we set aggressive targets that we are on track, I would expect, to achieve around the tree canopy, which has the added benefit, of course, of having an important public health benefit in addition to the carbon benefit as well. So, There is good work going on at the City of Portland. I don't want it to get lost in the concerns around the urgency of the moment. There are people throughout our city infrastructure, and as well as on the council, working tirelessly to meet the goals. But as our first testifier indicated today, the heat dome that we saw, temperatures in the City of Portland, 116 degrees, even as we were passing the proclamation last year, I don't think people saw that one coming. And it's even causing preeminent climate scientists, climatologists, and others to rethink the aggressive models that were in place only a year ago. And we're seeing more melting of the polar ice caps. We're seeing glaciers disappear more rapidly. We're seeing temperatures increase. We're seeing drier areas and areas that used to be important parts of our ecosystems. As one of our testifiers indicated today, I never thought in my lifetime I would read an article in the Oregonian about the imminent extinction of Pacific Northwest salmon. I mean, think about that for a minute. And as Director Durbin said right in our early presentation, this isn't linear. The problem grows at a greater than linear rate with each and every passing day. And therefore, it does require a sense of urgency. I appreciate that. Commissioner Rubio, I appreciate your leadership on this. I know you'll keep it front and center on behalf of all of us on the City Council. You'll let us know where our respective bureaus fit in and how we can help lead. And that's what we must do. And that's what this report underscores. I vote aye. Thank you all. The report is accepted. Keelan, I believe that was our only item of business for this afternoon. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
All right, thanks, colleagues. We had a long and productive week this week. I just want to acknowledge that. I want to thank you all for the extra time that we put in. Again, Commissioner Ryan, thank you for chairing the council yesterday. I feel very privileged to be a member of this City Council, and I thank you. We're adjourned.